This is the May 2000 edition of Functional Medicine Update, Volume 19, Number 5. Our topic for review this month will be peak performance. We have several reports on Side 1, including a look at the past millennium in medicine, pharmaceuticals under pressure, the postponement of aging, mitochondrial function and modulation, fatty acid regulation of gene expression, visual function and infant growth, DHA status and dyslexia, and the role of fatty acids in ADHD and atopic eczema. On Side 2, we continue reviewing peak performance in our interview with sports medicine expert Dr. Jeff Spencer. We will complete this edition of FMU with a comprehensive report on cardiovascular disease and today's advancement towards health. Here is Dr. Jeffrey Bland and the May 2000 edition of Functional Medicine Update.
Welcome to Functional Medicine Update for May 2000, the month of our 7th International Symposium on Functional Medicine, and I certainly hope that you've had the chance to visit us in Scottsdale, Arizona for this event. If not, hopefully you'll get the tapes and have a chance to review us post-symposium and find out what excitement went on there in Arizona. Well, you know, we're moving into the fifth month of the millennium year, and it's interesting to note that for many practitioners, the challenges that they have every day in dealing with their patients are different than they were 10 or 15 or 20 years ago, in which patients now are asking questions not just keeping alive, but functioning at high level and improving their basic performance. And therefore, this issue of Functional Medicine Update, I think, is very timely in that the focus is going to be on peak performance. How do we define peak performance? What is it all about? What are the expectations that people might have as it relates to peak performance? How does that translate itself into comprehensive health care, personalized preventive medicine, so to speak? And how does that interrelate with the perspective of functional medicine? All interesting questions that we'll be addressing in the course of this month's Functional Medicine Update. And we'll have the benefit of an extraordinary clinician of the month, someone who will take us through his experience as a peak performance facilitator in the area of sports medicine and sports nutrition. Well, you know, the New England Journal of Medicine just a few months ago had a retrospective looking back at the millennium in medicine in which they defined what they considered to be the principal seminal discoveries, the benchmark watershed discoveries that had been made in medicine throughout that millennium, the one that we just went through, actually. And they talk about the elucidation of human anatomy and physiology as being one of the major breakthroughs, that the workings of the body started to become more well understood from a mechanistic point of view. And then they moved to, say, the discovery of cells with the discovery of the microscope with Leeuwenhoek and how that opened up a whole other world, the invisible world that was a world within a world. And we started to see worlds within worlds, wheels within wheels as it turns to give rise to the ecosystem, the biosphere, and then even down to individualized parts within the human body of individual cells. So the discovery of cells and then their substructures, the organelles within cells that even reflect on a larger cycle the structure-function relationships of the whole cell or maybe even the tissue. The mitochondria, the nucleus, is the brain of the cell. The endoplasmic reticulum is the intestines of the cell, the circulature of the cell. So all of those things are very interesting parts of the breakthrough and the mechanistic understanding of body function. And then the elucidation, obviously, of the chemistry of life, the discovery of biochemistry, which really started to birth in the 19th century and blossom in the 20th century with Emil Fischer and the discovery of the structure of carbohydrate and the whole concept of Wöhler, in which the difference between inorganic and organic started to be lost in the conversion of isocyanate to urea, inorganic chemical to an organic chemical, and the fact that there was not some life force present in organic chemicals, the molecules of life that differentiated them from non-living molecules, the inorganic world that was really natures of how molecules were put together and how they were assembled into supramolecular structures. It gave rise to how we would differentiate living molecules from non-living molecules. And then the ability to assess the molecules of unhealthy living or disease by pathophysiological determinations in clinical chemistry was then born, looking at the sugars in the urine for diabetes or protein in the urine for diabetes and starting to examine chemical pathologies, as it were, and then how that led to genetic metabolism diseases, inborn errors of metabolism that could be reflected in single molecular changes, later to be seen as such things as sickle cell anemia with the single gene mutation that led to an amino acid substitution on the heavy chain of hemoglobin, giving rise to this complex disorder called sickle crisis that had not just a single organ affected, but rather the whole body as a sickled cell cut its way through the vasculature and produce damage to the body. So this concept of molecular medicine was born, which then was a term advanced by Linus Pauling in 1949. And then the application of statistics to medicine, another major threshold breakthrough. Epidemiology was born, the ability to look back and to apply the Friedrich Gauss concepts of the bell-shaped curve and start to look at standard deviations from a mean and predict, based on retrospective analysis, what might be prospective observations. The term epidemiology was born as a science within the field of medicine, in which we use biostatistics now more and more frequently to guide in decision-making, clinical decision-making. The whole risk-benefit equation is built on statistical evaluation and on probability statistics. As you know, Leonardo Fibonacci and the Fibonacci numbers, the Italian mathematician who I think lived from 1170 to about 1250, something like that, his contributions in helping to understand the nature of numbers and how statistics could be derived from numbers, and then later to be applied to biomedical sciences through Gauss's concepts of the statistical regression, and then later into actually one of the first people that used epidemiology and statistics for making a discovery in medicine is James Lind, the great Scottish surgeon who discovered the origin of scurvy as being associated with the absence of limes, of citrus, and the so-called British Navy limeys was derived from his retrospective, very detailed statistical analysis of the occurrence of scurvy in individuals in the Navy, the British Navy, who had been held in absence of fresh citrus. So we developed this very good backward-looking concept to look forward to then how we could treat and prevent scurvy by use of limes, a ration of lime juice every day for the sailor. A very interesting concept that then has changed medicine quite significantly. Then later with the development of anesthesia, and that obviously gave birth to the ability to do surgery in the Western world, because in the absence of anesthetic drugs, surgery was probably not going to be a very exciting discipline. With the advent of these new anesthetic drugs and the mechanism of action and their control, it opened up the interior of the body to surgical alterations and changes, and that led to a great birthing in the development of medicine as we know it. And then the obviously late 19th century, again early 20th century, discovery of the origin of disease coming from microbial infection, the Pasteur concepts, Jenner and Koch and their work on immunotherapy. This is a very extraordinary chapter in the evolving understanding. And notice how these discoveries are coming more closely spaced as we get closer to our present time. A major paradigm shifts in the way that we see the origin of disease and ultimately its treatment, because that led later then to the development of antibiotics with Fleming, Alexander Fleming's discovery of penicillin, and how that ultimately gave birth to the modern pharmaceutical industry as we know it, in which you could treat life-killing diseases miraculously with these mold metabolites that were called antibiotics and could lead overnight to the recovery of a patient with septic disease that would be an immediate threat to death. So certainly these are extraordinary chapters in this evolution of the model of medicine. And then the elucidation of the inheritance of genetics that occurred in the 20th century, moving beyond Mendel's laws into the whole nature of how inheritance is coded within the human genome and how that is related to the triplet code of the DNA molecules in our 23 pairs of chromosomes. What an extraordinary birthing of thought. It leads to understanding both the inborn errors of metabolism, but also the genetic plasticity, the polymorphism, the range of biochemical uniqueness that gave rise to Roger Williams talking about biochemical individualities, a concept back in the early 1950s as a major biochemist at the University of Texas and ex-president of the American Chemical Society, the discoverer of pantothenic acid, this whole concept of biochemical individuality that was then enriched by the discovery by Watson and Crick of the nature of the structure of DNA, and then later the elucidation of the code as a triplet code in the ATGC pairs. Then the knowledge of the immune system, which really started to emerge at the end of the 19th century once again and moving into the 20th century, and I find it interesting that actually, Dr. Linus Pauling, working collaboratively with colleagues at Caltech in the 1930s, was instrumental in forming the antibody-antigen structure-function relationship that gave rise to the modern view of how the immune system works and the elucidation of antibody structure from protein crystallography. So a wide range of contributions that Dr. Pauling made to the development of our modern paradigms of molecular medicine and biomedical thought. Certainly the understanding of the immune system, which is a lot like particle physics, isn't it? The more we look, the more small units we see. We started with gross morphological features of the immune system, and then we went to sub-features and then sub-sub-features, and now we're into the sub-sub-sub-features. It's a very differentiated artillery and infantry and aerial system of protection and offensive and defensive constituents that are related to our defense against the exterior and interior environment, while still maintaining the integrity with our own native cells. And the immune system is certainly the system of the late 20th century, early 21st century, that we seem to have learned the most about as a consequence of HIV and other infectious disorders, various hepatitis outbreaks and infectious disease around the world, and how lifestyle, diet, and environment influence the immune system. And then, of course, the development of body imaging, the use of various techniques, starting off with Madame Curie and her daughter to look with X-radiography inside the body. What an amazing concept if you think about that, the ability to see bones externally, you know, to actually observe what's going on internal to the body. This was a breakthrough as significant in changing our vision of human function as that of the microscope in looking at microbes and the relationship they had with health and disease. So as we moved from X-radiography, obviously, have moved from Röntgen, and who was a German physicist in 1845 to about 1925, who discovered X-rays, ultimately then moving through the whole nature of how X-radiography would then ultimately find itself with different contrast media being able to observe the body. And then now we're going into radiology being a field that's really a functional medicine field. In fact, it's fascinating that the most citations in the medical literature the last 2 years that have used the term functional medicine have been in radiology and neurology, because radiology is now moving to functional assessment tools, which are CT scanning and various non-invasive imagery that are actually looking at function within the body, not just tissues in static presentation. So you start looking at SPECT scanning, where you can actually examine metabolic functions of the body in real time. That leads to, obviously, the birthing of the modern pharmaceutical industry with corticosteroid drugs and the antimicrobial drugs, the antibiotics, and how Florey and Fleming and their extraordinary work on antibiotics with the development of penicillin really led to a whole breakthrough. And now a tool that medical doctors could use that differentiated them very significantly from other therapeutic modalities, because there was something that really worked miraculously with cortisone and with antibiotics that had not been previously available by any other traditional treatment. So it kind of separated medical doctors from the pack with the power of the prescription pad. Boy, that's a lot of P's there, isn't it? The power of the prescription pad is the ability to, with illegible script, to quickly give something to someone that makes them feel good in the transaction and sends them home feeling that they've been properly served. And in the early days of the prescription pad, it was often that was true, that they felt very satisfied having gotten an antibiotic to treat an antibiotic-sensitive infection. They felt miraculously better. But as we've seen, the extrapolation of that model into new chronic conditions that are not of bacterial direct origin has led often to less than positive responses, because the effects of the medication are not as successful as these antibiotics might have been in a bacterial infection, and the side effects become more well recognized over long-term administration. So there's this risk-benefit trade-off that we're starting to examine in that model. And that led to molecular pharmacotherapies, and as you know, we're getting into more specific ways of manipulating the function at the molecular level within cells, like H2 blocker drugs or proton pump inhibitors or ACE inhibitors, or, I mean, the list goes on and on now as we're starting to see more specific molecular interventions at specific enzyme levels or gene expression levels. And now we're moving into the age of genomics, the most recent breakthrough in which we're starting to individualize treatment, to personalize medicine based upon the genomic uniqueness of that individual. How does this translate then to peak performance? A very interesting question, because now patients come in saying, it's not just good enough for me to not be sick. I want to be truly well. I want to perform at high levels. I want to think well. I want to act well. I want to be available for eco-adventure tours at 75. I want to be involved with political activism. I want to interact with my grandkids by going out surfing with them in Waikiki. I mean, all sorts of interesting things that are expectations of living today at older age that were not present even a decade or two ago. That peak performance concept translates into getting the most from our genes. How do we squeeze out the highest phenotypic performance from our inherent limitations and strengths of our genotype? Well, you know, there's an individual who recently passed away that I think we should take a moment to honor, who helped us in a very valiant way, both as a scientist and as an activist, to understand that genotype-phenotype-environment connection, and that's Dr. Ernst Winder. Dr. Winder, born in 1923, recently passed away in 1999, and I think was really a paragon of much of what we consider a functional medicine investigator. As you probably know, he was one of the first people to take on the cigarette industry and articulate very clearly that cigarette smoking, this is back in the 1950s, was a contribution to a variety of age-related early-stage illnesses and ultimately premature death. And he went on to talk about the fact that prolonged use of tobacco, especially cigarettes, is an important factor in the induction of all sorts of illnesses, particularly bronchogenic cancer. And he had devoted himself untiringly to unearthing the causes of cancer and to persuading people to protect their health by modifying their environment so as to get the most from their genes in terms of their phenotype. Certainly, I think he would be honored and revered as a central figure in the 20th century in preventive medicine. He had a very forceful personality, but he was a very likable guy. Having met him several times, I felt that his contributions, both in terms of style, intellectual commitment, and his ability to get things done in the business community, was quite an amazing mixture. As you probably know, he was a medical doctor, but also very much involved with basic research and epidemiology as well, set up the American Health Foundation later in his professional career. He was really influenced in seeing an autopsy of a 42-year-old lung cancer patient who had smoked 2 packs of cigarettes per day, and that led him to devise a questionnaire and to interview patients with and without lung cancer. And from that, it became rapidly clear to him that there was a strong association between cigarette smoking and disease. This was when he was at Washington University School of Medicine, where he got his MD degree back in the late 1940s. He served a one-year internship at Georgetown University Medical School and Hospital in Washington, D.C., and became an assistant resident at Memorial Hospital for Cancer and Allied Diseases, later to become Sloan Kettering. He remained with Sloan Kettering until really 1999 in some capacity. He really had a tremendously strong presence over many decades in getting us to think about this gene-environment connection to our phenotype, particularly focusing on the area of smoking and cancer. Also, food and their phytonutrients and the modulation of cancer risk and how it influences aspects of function. The interest that I see that's emerging from this as it relates to performance and genotype-phenotype connection is being translated or alliterated in the pharmaceutical industry into what are being called lifestyle drugs. And you probably recognize that the pharmaceutical industry is under some great pressure. Although the industry did well in 1999, it is assumed by the investment committee that it wasn't good enough because of the considerable round of consolidations that are occurring within the pharmaceutical industry to try to join themselves together in such a way as to look more profitable, more successful, greater ROIs, return on investments to shareholders so that they will continue to show the growth potential and capital base that they have over the last couple of decades. One of the major areas that they are focusing on for R&D and new product development for the next few decades are what are called lifestyle drugs. Well, lifestyle drugs are things like Propecia for baldness, like Viagra, like Celebrex for inflammation. As you know, Celebrex or Vioxx are drugs that really don't treat any life-threatening disease necessarily, but they treat the infirmity and pain of osteoarthritis and the disability of chronic pain. So these are medications which are growing to be major placeholders in the portfolio of the pharmaceutical companies. It's recognized that these lifestyle drugs are there to meet the needs of consumers because consumers are asking for ways of maintaining peak performance or, let's say, high-level function as they age. And so we're moving away from the development of drugs to treat crisis illness to where the drug companies are spending much more money in trying to develop preparations or products to manage chronic infirmities and improve performance. And I could go through the whole nature of the SSRI revolution, and as you know, moving from the treatment of depression to now where we have applications of SSRIs for social anxiety disorders and other kinds of functional disorders that are really related to performance, stage fright, for instance, or agoraphobia, or feeling nervous because you have to interact with a group that you're socially uncomfortable with, so you take a SSRI drug to make yourself more able to perform at higher levels in this social situation. This is obviously a very significant departure from the use of a medication to treat a crisis illness or to treat a well-defined ICD-9 definable pathology. We're now moving into functional disorders that end up getting affixed with a name. It's called medicalization of symptoms. That is an interesting transition that's occurring as a consequence of the aging baby boomer and their desire to maintain peak performance or to even find peak performance as they move into their 50, 60, and 70-year age group. So this sounds a little bit like the end of the nature versus nurture controversy, because it sounds like we may are resolving the concept that, yes, we are nature as a consequence of our genes. When the sperm met the egg, we got whatever we got, and we've been working with it ever since. But we also have an effect of nurture, and that means the environment upon the genes and how they're expressed to give rise to our phenotype, which is our function that travels with us throughout life, and that's modifiable. The environment is modifiable. And this is really nicely described in a recent Scientific American article entitled The End of Nature versus Nurture, in which they talk about, yes, we are our genes, but our genes are really very plastic and have a lot of different ways of being expressed. They're pleomorphic as well as polymorphic, and therefore the environment and the conditions in which the genes are exposed over the course of our living, starting probably from the moment of conception, will give rise to how our phenotype or our outcome, our expression of function, is perceived. So the question that comes out of that is, well, gee whiz, then if all of these things aren't locked, hardwired into our genes, can we then postpone age-related diseases, or can aging be postponed? And that's a very interesting question that is certainly the forefront of people who have started to talk about anti-aging medicine. Is there a form of medicine that will prevent aging? Well, as you probably know, my particular bias is not to use the word anti-aging, because it tends to stigmatize aging as a negative process. Being an individual who is, like you, involved in that aging process, I don't find it necessarily a stigmatizing negative. I think it's actually desirable to gain the wisdom as we travel through life and to feel that you got solutions to problems that at a younger age you were unable to come up with because you didn't have that experience. And in fact, you tend to wash out and modify a lot of the visceral responses you had in youth because you were peaks and valleys type of emotional response to your world. And now you're starting to get a more smooth curve in how you respond to your world, and your love relationships are deep and warm and passionate and less punctuated by volatility. I guess the question is aging necessarily a bad thing? I often call youth that you're suffering from what is called small molecule disease. Small molecule disease meaning you're driven by small steroid molecules to make decisions that are not always in your evolutionary advantage. And as you grow older, those molecules tend to smooth out and you get a symphony of different regulatory process. And therefore, anti-aging to me may be a term that is a little bit off the beaten path of where we really should be going, which is healthy aging. It's modifying the expression of our genes to give rise to a phenotype of peak performance. So in a recent article in Scientific American by Dr. Michael Rose entitled Can Human Aging Be Postponed, they really describe the work that's going on in terms of rectangularizing the survival curve and extending the health span and life expectancy of an individual so they can rectangularize their view, and how there are certain genes that code for rapid aging, but for most of us, the expression of age-related diseases is only about 25% determined by the genetic hardwiring, about 75% determined by what we do to the genes and how we treat the genes over the course of a life. So there are early signs that we start to see that are functional changes of altered biological senescence or aging and age-related diseases. I mean, these can be very subtle changes, like forgetting to stop at a stop sign, or turning right when you should have turned left, or a slower reaction time, or vision problems, photophobia with dim lights, or impairment of hearing, or lower sensory perception to vibratory stimuli, altered glucose tolerance. These are things that precede what we might call age pathologies. And in fact, in Lancet magazine recently, this is volume 355 and page 84 in 2000, they have a little article entitled Might Olfactory Dysfunction Be a Marker for Early Alzheimer's, in which they talk about the fact that our nasopharynx and the nerves that are involved with olfaction are really directly related to central regions of the brain that are influenced by the neurofibrillary tangles of Alzheimer's, and therefore maybe the early stage dysfunction seen with Alzheimer's could be starting the change in olfaction and change in taste perception, because individuals' smell and taste are so closely tied together. So as old age people lose their sense of taste and lose their sense of smell, it may illustrate or indicate that there are other functional changes in the brain that are going on that we associate it with other neurological dysfunctions that would occur at later age. So if you have an APOE4 genotype and you start losing your sense of taste and smell, then that may be a very early warning sign of things that are going on that need attention related to the maintenance of cortical function. So here is a way of looking in a functional analysis at how people are performing, not just the examination for the presence of pathology, but looking for the presence of function or the absence of function. It's a new way of assessing, to use Dr. Leo Gallen's concept of patient-centered assessment. It's looking at the antecedents that are worked upon by triggers to give rise to the mediators that ultimately relate to the signs and symptoms that people have and experience as it relates to aging. The metaphor of a lifetime may be this phenotype-genotype connection. It's a wonderful article that appeared in a a journal that I read that I like very much, which is published out of the University of Chicago School of Medicine, Perspectives in Biological Medicine. And in their autumn 1999 issue, there was an article by Dr. Jeffrey Lewis entitled The Performance of a Lifetime, a Metaphor for the Phenotype, in which it talks about what's coming out of the Human Genome Project. That the Human Genome Project, which, as you know, is taking molecular biology into the public eye, was first thought to maybe discover how people were going to die by determining where in their genes they had these imperfections that would give rise to the cause of death. But what is being learned, as it points out, is not from the genome how people will die, but rather how they will live. What are the characteristics that give rise to their ability to perform and function over decades of living that gives them the ability to control the volume on their own genotype expression by what they do to the genotype? They have their hand in the volume control, even though in the past we may have thought the gene was hardwired and we had no control. Now we're starting to recognize that this very literal deterministic view of the gene is really very limiting and not actually correct with regard to what is being seen. So the deterministic metaphor of the gene is a pluripotentiality, not a deterministic hardwired outcome. Pluripotentiality. I think that's a very interesting point, that we've gone from determinism, which would be really, I guess, talked about in the Newtonian mechanics model of physics, F equals ma, kinetic energy equals 1/2 mv², which everything seems to be controlled by laws, the so-called Laplace's calculating demon, as if you could calculate all the laws of nature, you could define life, to where now we're moving to this concept of pluripotentiality and probability. This is the Einsteinian relativistic concept. This is the quantum concept that is weaving its way into physiology, to recognize in the genome are probabilities of function, pluripotentiality, that are only seen as discrete outcomes as a consequence of the way the genes marry themselves or influenced by the environment of the host, starting with that of conception and moving right on through older age. So I think this article by Dr. Lewis, A Metaphor for the Phenotype, is a very, very profound philosophical construct of where medicine and biology really will be going over the next, certainly the next century. As we recognize, there's a lot more that we can do than has been previously recognized in maintenance of our health. Well, there are things that certainly are locked into our genome, and I don't want to dismiss the fact that there are certain characteristics which we may have as biochemical Achilles heels that we have to deal with, one of which may be locked into the seat of our energy within cells, which is called the mitochondrion. And we have spent a considerable amount of time in Functional Medicine Update talking about the mitochondrion, the seat of energy of our body, the furnace of cells. And as you know, the mitochondrion is where oxygen is exchanged and food, in some sense, is combusted under the principles of respiration to give rise to the high energy, a reducing power of the cell, which is like a storage battery that can then transfer that energy to sites of need to give rise to functions such as muscle contraction, nerve firing, secretion, immune function, all the various things that are required to keep our body operating as an organized unit. Until a decade ago, few researchers outside cell or evolutionary biology had paid much attention to the mitochondrion. Now we see researchers have begun to see the more menacing side of these internal power plants because they produce oxidants like superoxide hydroxyl radical, hydrogen peroxide, and these high-energy oxidants can, in fact, damage the cell, create mitochondrial DNA mutations, can peroxidize mitochondrial membranes, and induce then oxidative shifts in the redox potential of cells that then alter gene expression by modifying cell signaling within the cell. So this is a very remarkable breakthrough in our understanding of the molecular aspects of premature cell death that surrounds what is called apoptosis or apoptosis. And this condition is often triggered by oxidative shift of the cell generated by the production of excessive mitochondrial oxidants. Well, there has been a discussion for some period of time within the field of gerontology as to whether there was any correlation between these mitochondrial oxidants and age-related dysfunctions. Many investigators, including Dr. George Martin, a University of Washington gerontologist, has talked about whether there's a correlation between oxidative stress and mitochondrial function and aging. He was recently quoted as saying there's no evidence that mitochondrial mutations functionally impair the cell or change the rate of mitochondrial replication. But a recent paper that just appeared in Science magazine has opened this question up for, I think, further consideration. This comes out of the group of Division of Biology University at the California Institute of Technology in Pasadena and the University of Milan. And the title of this paper is Aging-Dependent Large Accumulation of Point Mutations in Human Mitochondrial DNA. at the control region for replication. This is Science Magazine, Volume 286, page 774 in 1999. And I think it's a very fascinating study. It certainly doesn't prove exactly how mitochondria cause aging, but it opens up the story very nicely to mitochondrial dysfunction and aging and loss of performance. In this paper, they show that progressive damage to mitochondrial DNA during life is thought to contribute to the aging process. The idea has been difficult to reconcile with the small fraction of mitochondrial DNA so far found to be altered. In this paper, however, examination of mitochondrial DNA revealed high copy point mutations at specific positions in the control region for replication of mitochondrial DNA from old but not young human individuals. In longitudinal studies, one or more mutations appeared in an individual only at an advanced age, and these mutations appeared in more than one individual, suggesting that these mitochondrial hits or mutations in specific regions of the mitochondrial genome could prevent the mitochondria from replicating, which means that it would pass on an inefficient energy production to the daughter cells or to the cell if it was in a resting state, and lower the energy efficiency, which would be seen as fatigue and low energy performance. And, you know, the energy of life is what maintains our structure function, the neg entropy against the tendency of the universe to randomize itself. So therefore, if we lose energy, we're basically undergoing, or we lose biochemical energy in the energy of organization, we are then undergoing disorganization, which is called aging. So this may be one of the first papers to take a step forward in confirming the mitochondrial hypothesis of aging and the oxidant stress connection, and how that would then relate to, particularly in post-mitotic cells like the brain or the heart or the muscle, lowered function over time, which would then create low performance. We know that the mitochondrial membranes are made up of the same things that other membranes of the cell in our body are made up of, which are highly unsaturated fatty acids. And so we recognize that polyunsaturated fatty acids are more than just calories. They may also be raw materials to construct the body and to maintain its function. It's interesting to note that recently, lipid chemists, which were considered fat chemists, some of the least attractive disciplines within that of science, I mean, who wanted to be called a fat chemist? But nowadays, we're seeing lipid chemistry, biochemistry, becoming at the forefront, like nucleic acid biochemistry, of a very dynamic field because of the recognition that these particular essential fatty acids and particular lipids not only play a central role in the structure of the organism, but also play a central role in the chemical signaling or the cell signaling, because we now recognize that certain fatty acids are in fact regulators of gene expression. Isn't that a remarkable step forward in thinking that there are fats that actually influence the expression of genes, either can turn on or turn off certain characteristics of the genome? This is nicely reviewed in a recent paper in the Journal of Nutrition, Volume 128, page 923, entitled Polyunsaturated Fatty Acid Regulation of Gene Expression. And it turns out that the highly unsaturated omega-6 and omega-3 fats do, in fact, interact with various receptor sites, so-called nuclear receptor sites or the orphan nuclear receptors, like the peroxisome proliferated activated receptors alpha and gamma, which then have an influence on genome expression and then influence the phenotype of the organism. So when you eat certain fats, basically what we're saying is that you can influence the way your genes are being translated into messages, which then influence function, both at a morphological and a biochemical level. A very profound change in our whole view, isn't it, of how fats play a role in our diet and in our function. Well, we know that then may relate to such things as how dietary polyunsaturated fatty acids of certain families, particularly the omega-3 family, have been associated with lowered risk of cancer in animals who have been exposed to carcinogens. A paper that defines this is recently published in the journal Carcinogenesis, Volume 20, page 2209, in which they describe the role of dietary polyunsaturated omega-3 fatty acids and the cancer of the breast and colorectum, how it emerges from evidence that these omega-3 fats modulate gene expression that relate to oncogenes or chemical carcinogenesis. So certainly there's something very profound that we're learning about the different types of fats and the magnitude of fat in our diet and how that influences not only the construction of membranes and membrane transport, but also how that influences gene expression. This may also relate to such things as the construction of central structure such as the brain and the eye. As you know, omega-3 fatty acids play a very important role in the development of primates in ocular development, retinal development, and cortical brain development. This may explain why animals, primates, when deprived of omega-3 fatty acids in infancy, ultimately go on to have ocular difficulties and may even have immunochemical problems and may experience learning disabilities as well. I'm now quoting from an interesting paper that appeared in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, volume 71, page 120 in the year 2000, entitled A Randomized Trial of Different Ratios of Linoleic to Alpha-Linolenic, this is ALA, omega-3 fatty acid, in the diet of term infants, effects on visual function and growth. What they found was that lowering the linoleic acid to alpha-linolenic acid in formulas, that means raising the alpha-linolenic omega-3 component in the formula by using this low uric acid canola oil that was rich in ALA, resulted in a modest increase in plasma DHA. It was not found to have any effect on visual acuity or growth rate in these infants, but was seen to have a balancing effect upon the structure of phospholipids, incorporating more of the omega-3 fats at the 2 position. It may be that ALA is not the preferable fatty acid to offer, however, in these children, because it's possible that they cannot metabolize ALA into the 22-carbon atom highly unsaturated DHA very effectively, or the 20-carbon fatty acid EPA, eicosapentaenoic acid. And those are the downstream metabolites by desaturation elongation from ALA. So maybe it's to be seen that giving an ALA-enriched oil is not as effective as giving EPA or DHA in a preformed state to children, and we would have seen better improvement in visual acuity. We know that dark adaptation, motor skills, and learning can be influenced by deprivation of DHA. This is an interesting paper, again, American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, volume 71, page 323, in a supplement, year 2000, looking at dyslexia, motor skills, and dark adaptation, and DHA status. Now, again, I want to emphasize DHA is the 22-carbon atom fatty acid that's 6 double bonds, omega-3 fatty acid, that is the desaturated, elongated version of ALA. And many kids may not be able to adequately elaborate DHA from ALA, and therefore giving flaxseed oil, which contains ALA, or low uric acid canola oil that's high in ALA, is not the same as giving preformed algae-derived DHA or fish oil-derived EPA DHA. In this particular study, they looked at DHA supplementation specifically, and when considered with other evidence from closely related conditions such as ADHD, for which reduced ability to elongate and desaturate the essential fatty acid ALA to arachidonic acid or DHA respectively, this study suggests that there may be very important interrelationships between dyslexia, poor dark adaptation, and altered motor skills and DHA insufficiency. So again, it's giving the right fatty acid for the right functional effect. And as you probably know, there was a paper published in The Lancet about 7 years ago in the early 1990s, about 1993-94, that showed a correlation between what is analogous to really IQ in infants and their red cell DHA level. The higher the IQ, the higher the DHA level in their red cells. Again, you can't measure IQ specifically, but you can measure using psychometric indicators what are the prognostic indicators of IQ in later age kids. So do long-chain polyunsaturated fatty acids have a role in the modulation of function in kids with ADHD or dyslexia? Well, that's a question that's still a hypothesis waiting for full confirmation. However, there does appear to be enough suggestive evidence from double-blind placebo-controlled trials to indicate that there is a benefit by supplementing these children, particularly boys, is where most of the data is available, and this condition afflicts boys more frequently than girls, where ADHD can be improved by administration of omega-3 fats in the preformed DHA or EPA states. I might cite a paper, American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, volume 71, page 327 in the year 2000, that reviews the series of studies that have been done that link omega-3 chain elongated desaturated insufficiencies with ADHD. What about the other roles that these fatty acids have in modulating function and improving performance? How about atopic disorders and allergy and skin disorders? Again, David Horobin has been a very significant contributor to our understanding in this field. He has recently authored, Dr. David Horobin, a paper in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, again, volume 71, page 367 in the year 2000, entitled Essential Fatty Acid Metabolism and Its Modification in Atopic Eczema. And in this paper, he talks about the use of gamma-linoleic acid, GLA, which is a fatty acid that's a precursor to the 1-series prostanoids, anti-inflammatory, anti-cell-proliferative, anti-platelet adhesive. And that, in conjunction with the omega-3 EPA DHA, frames a very useful therapeutic tool for modulating atopic eczema, goes on to say Dr. Horobin in this paper. So the use of polyunsaturated fatty acids to promote proper skin integrity and immunochemical defense and lowered inflammatory potential seems to be gaining much more credibility. In fact, there are a variety of basic research studies that are now available. One that's interesting is the metabolism of polyunsaturated fatty acids by skin epidermal enzymes, the generation of anti-inflammatory and anti-proliferative metabolites. This is, again, by using cell culture work and examining the role of omega-6 GLA and omega-3 EPA in modulating pro-inflammatory mediators and showing that by giving in enriched levels of these, you can lower the level of inflammatory mediators and increase the level of anti-inflammatory mediators and anti-proliferative mediators that are associated with a thickening of the dermis that we associate with things like psoriasis. So that's American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, Volume 71, page 361 in the year 2000. And again, I emphasize that the role of these fatty acids can vary from person to person, and the balance is generally two parts of the omega-3 to one part of the omega-6 GLA, and the doses may be in the range of 6 to 10 grams a day of a complex mixture of EPA and, say, 2 to 3 grams per day of the complex mixture of GLA. Well, there's another interesting fatty acid in the news that I wanted to at least bring to your attention as it relates to peak performance and improving gene expression and getting the most out of our phenotype. It's a fatty acid that's been called conjugated linoleic acid. It's abbreviated CLA. We've alluded to it in past editions of Functional Medicine Update. But conjugated linoleic acid was first discovered as a constituent of several isomers within butterfat and cream and in milk, whole milk. And it appears to have a very interesting modulatory effect on a variety of functions, particularly working as an agonist through the PPAR, peroxisome proliferated activated receptor gamma binding site. So it can influence insulin sensitivity, improve insulin sensitivity. It can improve thermogenics. It can improve certain aspects of immune function, and it can lower the risk of certain types of carcinogen-induced cancer. This was first discovered by Dr. Michael Parisa at the University of Wisconsin and now has been extensively researched and evaluated by a variety of other investigators, including Dr. Martha Baluri at Purdue University, who we've had the fortune of having at our Functional Medicine Research Center recently to give us a seminar on CLA. There are some very nice review papers. One recently appeared in Currents, Opinions in Clinical Nutrition and Metabolism in 1999, Volume 2, page 499, talking about the role of CLA therapeutics in metabolic obesity, insulin resistance, and chemo prevention. I would urge, again, to keep your eye on this interesting new nutritional ingredient that is a fatty acid that, when given therapeutically at doses of a mixture of CLA isomers in the range of 5 to 6 grams a day, may have some very profound influences on things like type 2 diabetes and insulin resistance syndrome X, hyperinsulinemia. You know, we've also looked at the modulation effect of steroids, which are a type of lipid, but a complex lipid, on performance, and this is an area that is really having a considerable amount of discussion. The estrogen, progesterone, testosterone, cortisol connection, but particularly estrogen, progesterone, testosterone. And we're going to be speaking to this in much greater detail over the course of this year in Functional Medicine Update. But recently a paper was published in the Journal of Lipid Research, Volume 41, page 134 in 2000, that I thought was quite interesting. It was a study in animals looking at the effect of 17-beta-estradiol, which was found to act separately on LDL particles and to reduce the accumulation of LDL and the atherogenesis of LDL by preventing the stickiness of white cells to the arterial wall. The experiment suggested that estradiol decreased endothelial layer permeability, and incorporation of estradiol into the LDL particle prevented the binding of LDL to the artery wall. So there may be some very profound things as it relates to cell signaling that certain steroid hormones in the estrogen family have, and particular metabolites of estrogen have very different roles in how they influence function. So estrone, estradiol. Estradiol is hydroxylated in subsequent steps to estriol, and how those are conjugated and ultimately excreted become very important parts of the molecular communication system that can give rise to either normal function or optimized function to suboptimal function and increase risk to things like cardiovascular disease and even estrogen receptor positive induction of breast cancer. Individuals have used soy isoflavones to try to modulate hormones in women, and the phytoestrogens, as they're termed, like genistein and diazine in soy, have been often thought of as natural alternatives to estrogen replacement therapy. In a recent issue of The Lancet magazine, volume 355, page 163 in 2000, however, they go on to say that the genistein-diazine connection should not be considered as alternatives to the estrogen molecules. And in fact, they have a different mode of action, a different effect upon receptor sites, and don't produce the same influence biochemically or physiologically. So one should not jump to the conclusion that because you get some modest change in flushing with increasing soy in the diet in a menopausal woman, that necessarily you're getting the same effects on biochemical function as the natural hormones produced by that woman. So these are areas, again, of our further investigation and understanding. Let's turn to side two and continue our discussion of peak performance in this month's Functional Medicine Update. We have been so fortunate in the Clinician of the Month section of our Functional Medicine Update over the last many years to have what I think are some of the most remarkable clinicians and researchers who are really cutting new ground and opening up new ways to treat patients and manage complex problems in creative ways that really improve patient outcome. And that's really the whole reason for this Functional Medicine Update series, and specifically the Clinician of the Month, to acquaint you with people that are having success and doing it in ways that I think might be effective in the way that you think about your patients. And certainly we're so lucky this month once again to have a clinician of that expertise, Dr. Jeff Spencer, an individual who both professionally and personally I have admired for many years and who has really many talents as both very successful athlete in his own right and as now a doctor of chiropractic who has an extensive background in postgraduate studies in sports medicine, sports nutrition. Jeff really has, to me, cut the pattern as it relates to this whole field of integrated structural medicine and nutritional medicine in the sports arena. Jeff has worked with many elite athletes. I'll let him tell you about them as we go through the interview. But where the tire meets the road, the proverbial clinical how-to's outcome, this is a guy who's doing it every day. So it's with great privilege and pleasure that, Jeff, I welcome you to a Functional Medicine Update.
Great. Thank you, Jeff.
How in the world did you ever go from where you were in your life to where you are today as an expert in your field, in this case in sports medicine, sports nutrition? Can you give us a quick biographical kaleidoscope?
Well, you know, my background is in athletics. I was an Olympic cyclist in 1972, so I really had my first introduction to what the body's all about, you know, during my practical experiences as an athlete. And one of the very interesting things that I found that when I did get injured, the best thing that I could do is get back on my bicycle and get moving as quickly as possible. I didn't really know the biochemistry at that time, but it was very evident to me that movement and function were really the name of the game in terms of minimizing downtime from injury, as well as serving as a barometer for how my fitness was progressing. And once I discontinued my competitive career, I was a graduate student at the University of Southern California studying sports science. So the combination of academia with my practical experience really taught me that the lessons and the treatment that athletes were getting was severely insufficient, because it was always a, well, let's deal with it once it's broke problem. But in terms of defining parameters and developing strategies for optimizing performance and minimizing downtime and extending careers really was not there. So having been out of a formal learning setting for a while, I went back to chiropractic school because of my quest to try to create a comprehensive approach to the management of the athlete's health that would truly serve their need. And because of my background in art, I loved working with my hands, and it was natural for me to choose chiropractic in that respect. So that was really the springboard that I used in terms of creating a system that really met the comprehensive needs of the athlete, not only from a preparatory perspective, but also from a maintenance and a management perspective.
I think you have done such a beautiful job of teaching us about the athlete as a metaphor for the whole nature of personalized preventive care, because for a lot of individuals, they see the athlete as a person who has a very short window of opportunity to make their name known using their skills, and then they kind of burn out and we never hear about them after. And this whole concept of extending their productive performance lifetime and allowing them to continue at high levels of peak performance for a sustained period might be extrapolated to all of us who are not necessarily elite athletes, but trying to extend our own health and vitality for decades of living. So it seems like you've used the athlete as a metaphor for general preventive personalized health care.
I would say that's true. You know, in the athletic environment, it's a very explosive and very volatile, and you have this time condensation, which gives you a fertile ground for putting in leading technologies. The reality of it is that the technologies that are used for the athletes are no different than you'd use for the average person. I think that the clinician that looks at the athlete and the average public as separate entities is really making a fatal mistake and really discounting the capacity that the average person has for obtaining and maintaining their health throughout their lifetime.
Let's talk a little bit about how you integrate the structural aspects of performance with the mechanical and biochemical and nutritional aspects, because that's certainly a unique feature of what you do with your athletes.
Well, that's really the name of the game. You know, when we look at the concept of optimal function, the benefits of that are going to be certainly immediate performance enhancement, but also the reduced risk of injury and minimal downtime if a person does get injured, and extended longevity of career. So when we look at the body, both from the biomechanical and the biochemical aspect, and we're really treating the comprehensive needs of the person, in this case, the athlete. Traditionally, what I do with the athletes, we want to get some very important historical background in terms of sort of where they've been, and that really lets me know where the gaps in the action have been, and most frequently where they fall down is they have previous injuries that have not healed correctly, and even though the pain goes away, the body's still not functioning the way that it's really designed to. So I have a whole series of functional medicine biomechanical protocols that I do that tell me exactly where the breakdown in kinetic chain is happening so that I can really determine the weak link in the system, and then we develop strategies for dealing with that, very much like the biochemical functional medicine model, as so appropriately researched by you over the last 20 years. We don't look at a person's pain as the nature of the problem. We look at that as the body's cry that something is wrong and needs to be fixed, but it doesn't tell us what it is or what to do about it. That demands a little bit different type of look. So with the functional medicine biomechanical exam that I do on patients, a couple of neurologists actually in Czechoslovakia that have devised this system over the last 50 years, and it's really a brilliant, very energy, time-efficient way of observing how the biomechanical system is working. And then in terms of evaluating the biochemistry, through extensive history and diet analysis, it gives us information in terms of what testing we need to do to look at the parameters that may be affecting the whole biochemical propulsion and body growth and repair system. So it's really a combination of two based upon, you know, doing a functional exam biomechanically and doing the homework as far as the biochemical side goes.
I know that within the field of biomechanics, there are many different philosophies and different approaches. Some people use the skeletal system as the point of reference. Other people might use muscles. Other people might use other deep connective tissue. Other people might use soft tissue. Do you use an integrated approach in your biomechanical approach, or is there a focus that you found most successful?
Well, when it comes to biomechanics, we're really dealing with the neuromusculoskeletal system. The skeleton doesn't do anything but just sit there, and the muscles that go from one bone to another, when they contract, they locomote the system, but the muscles have no capacity to work on their own. That's under the direct control of the brain. So the brain needs to be able to do its job in terms of coordinating and controlling virtually every structure and function of the body, and the brain can learn to do things wrong. So when we look at how a patient or an athlete moves, which is what I do in a functional exam, that gives us clues as to how the brain's controlling movement. And you can get muscle substitution that leads to very energy inefficient movement patterns that puts increased strain and stress on structures that aren't designed to handle it. And the ultimate expression of that is going to be premature breakdown, overtraining, pain, and stiffness. So it's very much all along the lines of the biochemical model as well. I think someone that looks at the body through the eyes of structure is looking at frequently irrelevant details, because there's a very little correlation between structure and function. And, you know, Nockes, from the great Swedish researchers, said that only 85% of the time can you demonstrate imaging a reason for a person's complaint. And Carl Levitt, the brilliant Czechoslovakian neurologist, said that the doctor who only looks at pain is lost. And I think that those are very revealing statements in terms of how it is that we need to look at the patient. We not only need to look at the hardware, the muscles, the bone, ligaments, and tendons, but we also need to look at the software package, the brain and peripheral nervous system, and how it controls movement. And if we don't do that, then we're not looking at the body in terms of its dynamics. We're only taking a snapshot of it in one instant at a time, and that doesn't represent how the body's getting the job of life and function done.
After you complete this biomechanical analysis, do you then develop a personalized conditioning-type program for them? How does that end up in a therapeutic approach to that individual?
Yeah, we take the individual's needs, and then we create a personalized program for them, and it generally involves several different areas. Number one, we need to make sure that the articulations of the joints in the body are working correctly, because if the accessory motions are not restored, then there's no way the voluntary muscles that act on that can do their job correctly. How we assess and treat those, and that's an in-office procedure. And then we look at tight muscles, because tight muscles always inhibit their antagonist. And when we have muscle inhibition, then there's always muscle substitution, then all of a sudden you have neuromuscular chaos that leads to energy inefficient movement and strain on the body. So we develop a personalized stretching program for the patient, and sometimes we need to do that in the office. And then we develop strengthening protocols for those muscles that have been inhibited and the body is sort of taken out of the movement equation to reacquaint them with what they're supposed to do. And once we've done that, then we do some coordination exercises that to reestablish proprioceptive pathways between the brain and the muscles so that we develop energy-efficient movement. So it's really a patient-based active approach to care. It's not passive in any way, shape, or means. The name of the game is that if you create the right environment, then the body will always upgrade to the level of function demanded of it. I mean, it's a really a simple equation.
Oh, that's a beautiful concept. You know, you are an artist and obviously very gifted in terms of how you see things and translate into kinesthetics and manipulate your hands. I've had the pleasure of seeing some of your work. You have a talent that most of us, certainly me, don't have. So is this a technique that you can train other people who may not have that same gift that you've gotten?
Oh, you know, absolutely, Jeff. I think one of my greatest assets is my ability to communicate to people in a clinical-friendly way the how to look at it and what to do about it. Being a practicing clinician myself and not strictly an academician, I always look at what I do and what I share through the eyes of the practicing clinician. I have done this for about 8 years, taught seminars throughout the country to doctors that are interested in looking at clinically relevant and clinically friendly ways of implementing these procedures for their patients.
Well, let's move from the biomechanical over to the biochemical approach. Some individuals who may not be familiar with chiropractic as a full-service discipline in the area of health promotion, disease prevention, and therapeutics may not understand how a chiropractor would also look at biochemistry. So can you take us through how that becomes part of your overall program and assessment?
The biomechanics are purely the nuts and bolts of how things get done, but if you don't have the biochemistry to provide for body growth and repair, energy production, and the whole mechanical system suffers accordingly. So in my view, it's extremely important that we look at the patient comprehensively if we're trying to create a system that leads for long-term health, productivity, and function. So for me, it's essential that we have some procedures in motion that allow us to screen for certain things that certainly would affect the biochemistry and really see that a patient's overall health determines the rate at which they improve their musculoskeletal functions. The areas that I traditionally look at are what are the demands placed on the person, and if they're really excessive, and of course we look to the oxidative stress profile. Another thing that is somewhat rampant in biochemical end of athletics in the general population is the concept of allergies. You know, allergies are one of the quickest way that I know, whether they be food or airborne, that consume a person's energy needlessly. And then, you know, we also have the areas of essential fatty acids that I think that many people are very deficient in, and good weekly dietary summary would sort of give us clues as to how the macro and micronutrient balance and how the EFAs are playing their role in the biochemistry of the individual. The toxic load as well in terms of environment and what the sport demands and what their training systems are another area. So we kind of look at those through history and then we make our choices appropriately from that.
When you start talking to an athlete about this integrative approach, do you find that there is a general aha, intuitive understanding, or is it something you have to spend quite a bit of time to get them to see this integration from their own perspective?
Well, the higher up on the food chain the athlete is, the more open he is, because people that excel at what they do usually do so by virtue of the fact that they're very intelligent, so they really get the connections. And one of the beauties of working with athletes is they are in touch with their bodies, and they do understand performance. So it makes it very, very, very accessible. And today's athletic environment, there is a paradigm shift happening that's actually being propelled by the athlete, not so much the administration of professional athletic teams. It's making this an absolute necessity because we're looking for ways to enhance performance. And with a lot of the medical control issues that we're dealing with in sport today, it even makes this area much more fertile ground for further exploration.
I know that in each sport that we relish here in the United States and elsewhere in the world, there are those athletes who, and I can think of a few notable examples of this in individual sports, who have had incredible experiences of not missing games or competing at high levels for many more years than one would expect. And when you start looking at their lifestyles, often you'll see that they have chosen to march to a different drummer than some of their colleagues. And I wonder if anyone has studied some of these athletes that have extraordinary track records in keeping healthy and high-level performance for many years versus those that come and burn out very quickly.
I think traditionally if we look at the health management systems of most professional teams, that's hugely overlooked, and it's always amazing to me why professional teams would spend millions and millions and millions of dollars on salaries that virtually have no system in place to protect their investment by looking at the things that are well known to be able to prematurely terminate people's careers. So I would say that this is the leading edge of, I believe, where preparation really needs to begin. And I kind of see some suggestions of that happening in the athletic community.
Well, let's move from the general discussion to maybe a few examples from your own experience where our listeners might understand how this works with an individual. Without divulging any proprietary relationships, maybe you can just tell us about some generic examples of athletes that you feel comfortable describing.
Sure. Well, probably the most recent example that everybody would be familiar with was the 1999 Tour de France. You know, I am Lance Armstrong's chiropractor, and Lance's win last year was one of the greatest comebacks in the history of sport, having fought his way back from testicular cancer that had metastasized to his lungs and his brain, for which he did have brain surgery. Very, very aggressive chemotherapy as well as other surgery, and the demands of the Tour de France are excessive, to say the least, in terms of what they have to deal with. It's 21 days of racing on a bike in any type of climatic condition possible, at least 5 to 7 hours a day, day after day after day after day. So the things that we've got to deal with there are the concept of sickness, overuse injury, oxidative stress. So probably one very, very interesting example that happened in last year's tour is that one of Lance's teammates, so we do blood work every day on the team, and we could see that his hematocrit was starting to drop, so we knew that he was on his way to getting sick, even though he didn't have any symptomology at that time, and you could see him start to get kind of puffy, so there was a real shift from intracellular to extracellular fluid, which is a key to us that things are happening. It's interesting, too, that this person does have a history of asthma and allergy, and one of the things that we did this past off season is that we did some comprehensive testing on an allergy profile, and we developed some strategies in terms of some anti-inflammatory procedures as well as some dietary changes that really turned his whole off-season program completely around. So that's one example of that. The other thing is during the tour, the use of antioxidants to be able to minimize the oxidative stress on the body is another example of that, and probably the most validating thing for me is that the director of the team last year said that he'd never seen anything like it, because generally when athletes start to develop overuse strain and their bodies start to fade in the tour, they slide off into oblivion, and what actually happened last year is that the team came back stronger than ever, and he acknowledged to me the fact that the nutritional protocols that we had put in place through supplementation, in addition to the physical medicine things that I brought to the team, were responsible for that type of thing. So it was very gratifying for me.
And as you've worked through this extraordinary process with Lance Armstrong, which will be one of the great scripts of a motivational movie, I'm sure.
Yeah, it's in the works.
Well, that's, I would expect so, yeah. This will rival Steve Prefontaine, I'm sure, when we see it. But what kind of things can be a takeaway for those of us who weren't fortunate to be involved in a day-by-day basis through this process? Are there some general things that you learned that might be helpful for our listeners about this whole process?
Yeah, I would say that it's exactly the same for the Tour de France cyclist as it is for the average person. When you look at the things that are going to sabotage the biochemistry and the biomechanics of the body, it's all the same. And you need to look at past history. You need to look at things that were not addressed in a functional way during development or during previous injury, and you need to develop strategies for supporting functional reserve and making up for functional deficits. So the things that I always do based upon history is that where I feel that clinical and testing protocols need to be done, you know, all the great smoky diagnostic labs, for me, doing the oxidative stress profile, essential fatty acids and amino acid profiles and comprehensive digestive stool analysis. And allergy profiles are extremely important for the athletes and people that I work with, because that's generally one of the first lines of hidden breakdown in the body. So based upon histories, that would serve as our roadmap as to what choices that we select. On the biomechanical side of things, to do a functional exam on the patient and to realize that where a person hurts is generally not their problem. That's usually where too much stress is going because other things aren't working. And to be able to develop a series of functional tests that allow you to find out where the key link is breaking down in the locomotive system, and then supporting a person nutritionally from a foundational perspective, which would be good macronutrient and micronutrient balancing and diet analysis, as well as dealing with the individualized needs that the patient has in terms of a dietary review and the results that come back from the testing protocols. And it's a winner for everybody, and as far as I'm concerned, if we look at the concept of athletic careers and people's lives, for that matter, it's all a matter of being able to look through the lens of what's happening now as a preview of what's to come. And if you wait for things to show up to think something's wrong, then you've really missed the boat. It becomes a lot more difficult. And in today's healthcare climate, people realize that, and there's 290 million Americans that all need some level of healthcare along the lines of function. So there's more than enough patients to go around. It's our job as clinicians to be able to create a system that brings a level of awareness to the patient that the lives that they lead can be greatly enhanced by them taking an active role in their decision-making, because the technology is there.
Well, that's a beautiful summary of lots of words that we've put on this tape series over the years. Thank you for that eloquence. I know that you see in a real world every day the concepts of biochemical individuality or genomic uniqueness. And in athletics, I've heard terms like slow and fast twitch muscle uniqueness or loose and tight connective tissue uniqueness or power versus endurance athletic uniqueness. As you assess these athletes in terms of where they are in their performance and their own function, do you ever run into the situation where you've observed an individual who's in one sport whose uniqueness might be better in a different sport? I mean, is there something that sometimes you have to tell them, like these repetitive injuries are because you're doing something your body's really not designed to do?
Well, I think a person's practical experience will dictate where they belong, and they usually gravitate towards that. The thing that I see is the biggest problem, not only from an athlete's perspective, but also from an administrator and a trainer and a medical staff perspective, is that we look at what's being done, but we don't understand why it's happening. An example is at the Olympic Training Center, when I was there in Colorado Springs, they were looking at a cyclist pedal stroke, and they saw that his heel was not moving correctly, and that if he only dropped his heel, he would get more power out of his stroke. So the recommendation was, well, drop your heel. Well, come on now. I mean, why is it happening? Nobody ever asked that question, because in a way that we look at these problems of performance and function in life is through the eyes of how we feel and what we do, not through the eyes of what's causing us to behave the way we are and what is our potential. So I think the whole shift has got to dramatically change here if we're really going to look at how do we prolong a person's longevity in terms of their capacity for embracing life. For me, the important criteria here is that we're dealing with people's destinies and people's futures. We're not just dealing with sports performance. And the greatest gift that we can give people is the knowledge and the opportunity to have a long, productive life that extends beyond the athletic career. And the only way that we can do that is to be able to look at the reality of biochemistry and biomechanics through the eyes of what's creating the three-dimensional reality that we're seeing. We've got to look behind the scenes. And the technology's there, and everything that you've done has certainly been the pioneering effort in that respect. And we all certainly owe you a great debt of gratitude for that.
Well, thanks. I think we're a part of a really interesting team of evolving understanding. And I guess that leads me really to the last question. It's a question I'd like you to feel the freedom to speculate. Chiropractic, like all fields of healthcare, is now undergoing a transformation, a change. Managed care has had its vector of catalytic change. And as you look forward to chiropractic as a profession, what would you say to young chiropractors coming up in terms of how they might see their own profession?
I think right now this is the greatest opportunity in healthcare there's ever been for any practicing clinician, regardless of discipline, because we have a population that is not responsive and no longer willing to embrace traditional healthcare, whether it be chiropractic or whether it be medicine or any of the other disciplines, but they're looking for reasonable alternatives that can be rationally explained, and they're willing to pay cash for it, because most people have already spent thousands of dollars anyhow, spinning their wheels and going nowhere. So I feel that this is a patient-driven process that has created this opportunity for us to create the practice that we've always wanted to have, where patients come in, they know why they're coming, they're willing to take their position as being the driving force for doing the doing part of change and taking an active role in that, and they're looking to us for reasonable and rational guidance. And I think that that leads a level of credibility that's demanded of the professional and accountability that I think is long overdue. Plus, it allows the doctor and the patient to have a cooperative relationship where through the doctor's guidance and the patient's doing and the patient's willing to pay cash for it, that they both embrace this thing called life and can have a lifetime of relationship in a professional way that leads to the best of all worlds for both the doctor and for the patient. There's never been a better time, Jeff.
Wow, that's a beautiful way to close this discussion. And Dr. Jeff Spencer, where can people follow up if they would like to with what you're doing and some of the thoughts that you've imparted?
Well, they can contact me anytime through my office, area code 541-474-6310. and I'll be at that number for at least a couple of more months because there is a change in the works here. I will be relocating in a couple of months.
We want to thank you so much for taking the time with us. It really gives us a very optimistic vision as to where this horizon is and where we're all going. Thanks for sharing your insight and years of clinical experience.
Well, you're welcome, Jeff. The future has never been brighter, and a great deal of thanks to you for helping solve the biochemical puzzle for myself because that was the missing link. Great big thank you to you and everybody that you're associated with for that help, and I look forward to the relationship growing in the future.
Thank you, and we'll talk to you soon.
Great. Thank you, Jeff.
Once again, I want to thank Dr. Spencer for really helping us to understand a metaphor for all of peak performance, and that is in the athlete who is asking special things of their body each day. And kind of a concentrated window is the example of what we're talking about as it relates to function throughout the course of a life, 70, 80, 90, or 100 years of high-level living. Let's talk again about some of these agents that manipulate performance and function. And I was talking earlier about soy isoflavones. We probably recognize from previous discussions that although soy isoflavones shouldn't be considered as a substitute for natural estrogens produced by a woman or a man to that extent as well, as you know, there are essential amounts of estrogen produced by males as well. But rather, we should look at soy as the whole of a complex mixture of soy fibers, soy neutral plant sterols, soy isoflavones, and soy protein with a unique balance of amino acids. And we recognize from James Anderson's paper that he published in the New England Journal of Medicine a few years ago, a meta-analysis of the role that soy has in cardiovascular disease. This New England Journal of Medicine paper indicated that there was a very significant statistical correlation between increased levels of soy in the diet and reduced the incidence of cardiovascular disease. This is further amplified in a very nice review paper in the Journal of Nutrition, volume 128, page 1589, again talking about soy protein isoflavones and cardiovascular disease risk, in which it's shown that you could not think of a better drug, probably, than soy for helping to reduce cardiovascular disease. It lowers the synthesis of cholesterol. It reduces the enterohepatic recirculation of cholesterol. It blocks the rate-limiting step, HMG-CoA reductase step, as it relates to de novo cholesterol biosynthesis. It increases the conversion of cholesterol by 7-alpha cholesterol hydroxylase into bile salts, which is a major way your body gets rid of cholesterol. So therefore, there are multiple ways that soy and its constituents influence positively the control of a risk factor to heart disease called hypercholesterolemia and LDL elevations. As you know, cardiology has moved to become more of a preventive medicine-focused discipline with the development of the statin drugs and fibrates, which are drugs that influence cholesterol and cholesterol dynamics and maybe inflammation associated with heart disease in terms of the fibrates. A recent beautiful editorial in the JAMA, authored by Dr. Claude L'Enfant, a very well-known cardiovascular investigator, has gone on to say, how do we conquer cardiovascular disease? Is it more than just cholesterol management? And, of course, we do see this nice paper published in the JAMA, volume 282, page 2043, entitled Preventing Coronary Artery Disease by Lowering Cholesterol Levels, 50 Years from Bench to Bedside, in which it is seen that there's a very strong encouragement for lowering elevated cholesterols because of the profound statistical reduction in risk to cardiovascular disease. However, as we also recognize, there are many individuals who have low cholesterols and low LDLs who go on to experience cardiovascular events by extended risk factors, which we're only now discovering. Some of those extended risk factors include such things as the presence of insulin resistance and hyperinsulinemia syndrome, which then causes alterations in arterial dynamics, platelet adhesion, and the stickiness of white cells, such as associated with alterations in intracellular adhesion molecules and vascular-associated adhesion molecules, stickiness of macrophages, and later conversion of foam cells and LDL oxidation, and all the things that we associate with the atherogenic process that may not be directly related to cholesterol, but more to inflammatory mediators and the promotion as a consequence of hyperinsulinemia, insulin resistance, which appears to be a major cholesterol-independent risk factor to heart disease. We recognize that there are a variety of ways of modulating the insulin resistance syndrome. We have been talking and doing research in our Functional Medicine Research Center on this issue now for the past 6 years, and have come quite a ways in better understanding the modulation of this problem. However, one of the things, it's a very simple therapy which should be introduced as a principal therapy for peak performance, is that which Dr. Spencer talked about, and we can apply it directly to this hyperinsulinemia syndrome, which is exercise. Exercise is a very profound tool in improving insulin sensitivity and glucose removal and glucose transport. And the question has always been, well, how heavy do I have to exercise? Is the exercise near exhaustion and near death? Because even thinking exercise for some people is enough to give them paranoia. and anxiety. So how much do you need to exercise? And a very interesting and I think empowering, to use a term that's overused, a study that was appeared in JAMA, volume 282, page 1433, discusses walking compared with vigorous physical exercise to normalize insulin and glucose levels in women. And the data suggests that one could get substantial reduction in the risk to type 2 diabetes by moderate intensity exercise as simple as a regular walking program. Every individual can find something that will raise their aerobic potential into their training zone, even if they can't walk, something that is even isometric that can accomplish that. And it doesn't require super vigorous exercise in order to improve those functions that we associate with glucose removal, glucose transport, and insulin sensitivity. We've also seen beyond the insulin resistance, hyperinsulinemia syndrome as an extended risk factor for cardiovascular disease, the appearance of homocysteemia, hyperhomocysteemia, as being an important risk factor for consideration. And it's in a relationship with the necessity for increased levels of vitamin B12, vitamin B6, and folate. We now recognize that for some individuals who have a metabolic defect as a consequence of a gene polymorphism mutation, at the gene called 5-10-methylene tetrahydrofolate reductase. This is an enzyme that we've talked about at length within Functional Medicine Update, and it's a very common polymorphic mutation within humans. But that block may then require either very high doses of folate and B12 to push through the block, or one might use a downstream derivative of folic acid called 5-methyl tetrahydrofolate. 5-methyl tetrahydrofolate avoids that genetic mutation and can then stimulate the downstream metabolic processes related to the clearance and the metabolism of homocysteine. This is discussed in a recent article in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, volume 70, page 904, talking about serum concentrations of vitamin B12, homocysteine, and their interrelationship to methylmalonic acid in an elderly population, indicating once again that elevations in methylmalonic acid are functional indicators of B12 and folate insufficiency, and that even if a person seems to be getting adequate levels in their diet, if they have elevations of methylmalonic acid, it is an indicator that they're not getting functional adequate levels at the cell, and therefore they need to increase or improve their folate B12 and B6 status. The other area, obviously, that has been discussed as an extended risk factor to heart disease is the oxidation area, and we tied that together with mitochondrial uncoupling and free radical oxidative shifts and redox potential within cells. And the term oxidants is kind of a loosely used term. Reactive oxygen species or oxidative stress are all terms that are thrown around rather cavalierly that may have very specific definitions within the field of cell physiology. However, it is recognized that oxidized low-density lipoprotein cholesterol has a variety of components that are not present in native LDL, and that this oxidized LDL can participate in what might be called atherogenesis or pro-atherogenic properties from examining both in vitro cell culture systems and animal models and even some retrospective human data. So it appears that there are numerous contributing factors that can contribute to oxidative shifts that associate themselves with atherogenesis. And then we get into the discussion, well, can antioxidants be used to prevent that oxidative shift? And this is a question that is certainly under great scrutiny and a lot of research interest, but it does appear that antioxidant therapy as a complex array of antioxidants may help balance these redox potentials within cell. It may not just be the antioxidant of the month club, a single antioxidant given at high dose. We can mark some of these oxidative shifts using various kinds of biochemical markers. One that is receiving a lot of attention is the level of 8-hydroxydeoxyguanosine, or what has been abbreviated 8-OHDG. 8-hydroxydeoxyguanosine is an oxidative marker for damaged DNA that occurs in cells as a consequence of oxidative stress. A number of papers have talked about the levels of 8-OHDG as a marker of DNA damage, one that you might want to refer to as in Free Radical Medicine and Biology, volume 28, page 13, the year 2000, which starts to indicate that this is a good indicator of damage that has occurred within the cell to the genetic material as a consequence of oxidative shifts. Then the question you might ask is, using this marker, can you show that it is altered when you put a person on a complex antioxidant diet? That's a very interesting, where the tire meets the road, clinical question. And an interesting paper that appeared in Carcinogenesis, volume 20, page 2261, I find very fascinating because the goal of this study was to test the hypothesis that increased consumption of vegetables and fruits that are rich in complex antioxidants and polyphenolic substances could reduce the markers of oxidative stress that was assessed in either blood or urine. In this particular paper, 28 women participated in a 14-day dietary intervention. They used 8-OHDG, 8-hydroxydeoxyguanosine, as the marker for DNA damage due to oxidative stress before, during, and after the dietary intervention. The subjects were free-living and consumed a completely defined recipe-based diet to increase the average daily consumption of vegetables and fruits from 5.8 servings at baseline to 12 servings throughout the intervention. Overall, the level of 8-OHDG in the DNA isolated from the white blood cell lymphocytes and in the urine, and the level found in the urine, was reduced by the fruit and vegetable intervention. The malondialdehyde, or MDA, levels, which is a measurement of lipid peroxides, were not altered, indicating that 8-OHDG may be a more sensitive indicator of oxidative damage than that of lipid peroxides. The results of this study indicate that the consumption of fruit and vegetables, including lots of antioxidants and complex redox form, significantly influences then reductions in the markers of oxidative stress to both DNA and ultimately to lipids. And therefore, it's important, as they say, to get a diverse number of botanical families containing these antioxidants. And there is a different role of these complex matrix of redox active substances versus giving single antioxidants one at a time or even two or three at a time. I think that is where the field is moving, to recognize that single antioxidants in a pharmacological model are not nearly the same as complex antioxidants found in a food-based system that have been concentrated and delivered in their redox active form. So how does that relate then to the studies that the shoots have got us to believe vitamin E and heart disease? Does that mean that vitamin E has no value in heart disease? Well, certainly, I don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater in this discussion. We cannot, nor should we, conclude that single antioxidants have no value and that vitamin E should never be given by itself. However, what I've tried to bring to understanding is the emergence of a philosophy around antioxidants as a buddy system, a team working together to diffuse high-energy oxidants, to diffuse them and uncouple them before they can create oxidative damage, and to diffuse them down to molecules that have low oxidative potential through this kind of stepwise fashion of redox chemistry. We have seen a very interesting paper that appeared in the Journal of Nutrition, Volume 128, page 1593, that I thought was fascinating, entitled Vitamin E in Atherosclerosis. And it was fascinating because it was one of the first papers in the true science or literature, the American Institute of Nutrition, some of the high-level nutrition research literature, that cited the discoveries made by the Shute brothers in London, Ontario. They go on to say that vitamin E was advocated as an effective treatment for heart disease by Dr. Evan Shute of London, Ontario, more than 50 years ago. His pioneering claims, which were unacceptable to the medical community at large, have been confirmed by recent findings from epidemiological studies and a limited number of intervention clinical trials. In this review, they talk about vitamin E enrichment, which has been shown to retard LDL oxidation, inhibit the proliferation of smooth muscle cells, inhibit platelet adhesion and aggregation, inhibit the expression and function of adhesion molecules such as ICAM and VCAM1, attenuate the synthesis of leukotrienes, the pro-inflammatory mediators, the second signal messengers, and potentiate the release of prostacyclin through upregulating the expression of cytosolic phospholipase A2 and cyclooxygenase, which are useful in helping to form the right balance of prostanoids of the anti-inflammatory and pro-inflammatory family. So it appears as if we're emerging the biological molecular mechanism for the action of vitamin E. So I don't want to throw out the fact that vitamin E has a very important role to play and should never be taken as a single nutrient. But what I should say is it plays its role within the context of these other redox active substances. The same theme is really mirrored in a New England Journal of Medicine paper, volume 342, page 154 in the year 2000, entitled Vitamin E Supplementation and Cardiovascular Events in High-Risk Patients. This is the Heart Outcomes Prevention Evaluation Study, and as you probably know, in this particular paper, in patients at high risk for cardiovascular events, treatment with vitamin E for a mean of 4.5 years was found to have no apparent effect on cardiovascular outcomes. And so, therefore, one might ask all sorts of questions as to why 400 IUs of vitamin E daily, given from natural sources, RRR, tocopherol, over 4.5 years, did not lead to any statistical improvement in secondary outcomes, including unstable angina, congestive heart failure, revascularization or amputation, death by any cause. And this was 772 of the 4,761 patients assigned to vitamin E, and 739 of the 478 assigned to placebo, in which outcome primary events were followed. So, you know, again, I want to emphasize one should not jump on a single nutrient bandwagon at the exclusion of looking at all the other variables. Dr. William Pryor has authored a very beautiful review of vitamin E and heart disease, Basic Science to Clinical Intervention Trials, as the senior editor of the Free Radical Biology and Medicine Journal. This is volume 28, page 141 in the year 2000. In the bibliography, there are 244 citations, so if you're a bibliophile, you can really get a lot of referential material here. He says the scientific community must recognize that there will never be a time when the science is complete and we know all the answers surrounding vitamin E. At some point, the weight of the scientific evidence must be judged adequate. Although some may regard it as early to that judgment now, clearly we are very close. In view of the very low risk of reasonable supplementation with vitamin E and the difficulty in obtaining more than about 30 IUs per day from a balanced diet, some supplementation appears prudent now, according to Dr. Pryor, and I quote from that paper. Again, I want to look at this in the complex nature of the evidence in the literature, not to try to dissuade anyone from using single antioxidant supplements such as vitamin E, but rather to look at it in the context of the whole. We've recently seen a paper that talks about vitamin C supplementation at 500 milligrams a day, increasing arterial intimal thickening, suggesting that maybe it's an atherogenic agent in some individuals given at 500 milligrams per day. There's some very interesting questions about this study in terms of self-selection. It wasn't a randomized trial and various aspects of the study protocol. But suffice it to say that once again, what we're coming to recognize is that complex mixtures of antioxidants in enhanced levels are more likely to give the right message to the genes to control things of oxidative stress. What about high doses of vitamin E in the treatment of disorders of the central nervous system in the age? And as you know, this is work that's been done at Tufts University Medical School and the USDA Human Nutrition Center on Aging in Boston. And a recent paper described this as American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, volume 70, page 793, in which they looked at experiences with very high doses, 2,000 international units of vitamin E daily. We've seen this in the Parkinsonism trial, the Stanley Fon work on Parkinsonism, the safety and efficacy of supplemental vitamin E over periods of many years, and the prevention of neurologic disease, they go on to say, has not been adequately explored at this certainly high level. But there are some presumptive conclusions that it has been benefit in some individuals, for instance, with Parkinsonism, and maybe even have some role to play in Alzheimer's as well. So we can say that antioxidants are still on the frontier of further investigation. A paper in the Lancet recently that talked about the effect of antioxidants and the occurrence of preeclampsia in women who are at increased risk to eclampsia. And they used vitamin E and vitamin C supplements in this study, 1,000 milligrams per day of vitamin C and 400 IUs per day of vitamin E. And the supplementation with vitamin E and C they found to be potentially beneficial in the prevention of preeclampsia in women who are at increased risk of this disease. And there's an editorial that follows this entitled, Is Oxidative Stress the Link in the Two-Stage Model of Preeclampsia, in which it describes how it is that antioxidants could play a positive role in reducing the risk to eclampsia in these individuals. That's Lancet, volume 354, page 810, for those of you following it. And then, of course, you've got other antioxidants in the news, like coenzyme Q10, new indications of its antioxidant value, the Journal of Nutritional and Environmental Medicine, volume 9, page 223, 100 milligrams a day of CoQ10 for individuals who have different types of oxidative stress-related dysfunctions, including kidney disease, neurological disorders, cardiomyopathies, and even individuals on cholesterol-lowering drugs. The statins may benefit from supplemental coenzyme Q10. And then let us not forget N-acetylcysteine as a precursor for glutathione and the regulation of glutathione intracellular levels. And even topically used for skin inflammation, it was found to be beneficial in lowering ichthyosis by lowering inflammation. This is the Lancet, volume 354, page 1880, showing how its 5% solution applied topically lowered skin inflammation. It's also been used orally in the treatment of HIV-positive patients in improving immune function and lowering oxidative stress. This is a very nice paper that recently published in the Current Opinion in Clinical Nutrition and Metabolic Care, volume 2, page 493. So there's lots yet to learn about antioxidants and their role in peak performance. But certainly, I think you can see in close for this month's Functional Medicine Update that the future is open to go beyond that of the treatment of crisis disease to the area of peak performance, extension of health span, and functional improvement. And that's what we'll be discussing the rest of this year in Functional Medicine Update. See you in June. Thanks so much.
Functional Medicine Update is copyrighted by the Institute for Functional Medicine, Incorporated, located in Gig Harbor, Washington, USA. Reproduction in any form is prohibited.